This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Good morning.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We may have a better idea this morning of the strength and limits of the Tea Party movement and the sturdiness of incumbents. In Alaska, though votes are still being counted, that's a place where Sarah Palin backed an insurgent candidate, and that's leaving Senator Lisa Murkowski fighting for her political life.
In Arizona, longtime Senator John McCain easily defeated his more conservative Republican challenger, J.D. Hayworth.
And in Florida, Congressman Kendrick Meek won the Democratic Party's nomination for Senate, defeating a real estate billionaire. But in that state's Republican primary for governor, the outlook is different. There, the establishment candidate was beaten by a conservative rival. Joining us to talk about the primaries and party finances is NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Renee?
Pretty good. Let's go back to that Alaska race. Still, up in the air, not concluded yet. What's going on there?
Well, it's a stunning outcome from the Washington perspective. People here are shaking their heads because what you have is, as of this morning, challenger Joe Miller is leading Lisa Murkowski, who's not only the incumbent, but she's part of a dynasty in Alaska, having succeeded her father in the Senate. And Joe Miller's leading by about 3,000 votes, about 52% to 48%, with 80% of the vote in as of early this morning. But, you know, there are about half of the absentee ballots remaining still out. So the final result may not be known for weeks. But even as it stands, this is a stunning result. Polls had Murkowski, one of the leading Republican senators, up big just 3 weeks ago. But she is in favor of abortion rights, and Miller has been highly critical of her on that point. And there was also a ballot measure on abortion yesterday that brought out support for Miller, who's a West Point and Yale Law School graduate.
Now, Juan, Sarah Palin, as I just said, endorsed the challenger to Murkowski. She's endorsed other candidates. What does it say about her role in this race and maybe just generally?
Well, you know, she's the former governor, obviously, in Alaska. But it's really interesting how this worked, Renee, because Todd Palin, her husband, had a fundraiser for Miller back in May. And then in June, Sarah Palin herself endorsed him, but she did so on Facebook. And called him a common sense constitutional conservative. But this comes after Palin had donated to Murkowski earlier this year. So very curious. But the Tea Party then jumped in, given what right. Sarah Palin had done, and spent $300,000 in support of Joe Miller.
Yeah, okay. Juan, let's get on to the finances. Let's start with the Republican Party establishment. They're actually hurting a bit, it would appear.
Oh, yes, they are, because what you're seeing right now is that the Republican National Committee is reporting very low fundraising totals, trailing the Democrats at this point and creating a lot of concern as to whether or not the Republican National Committee can support things like voter get out the vote, telephone banks and the like. Meanwhile, the money is going into places like the Republican Governors Association, led by Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. So there's some infighting as to where money is flowing in the Republican ranks, and right now it looks like the RNC is hurting.
Yeah, well, may we ask, and we've just got about 30 seconds here, how much of this is attributable to the man who runs the Republican National Committee? That's Michael Steele.
Yeah, well, Michael Steele has made some gaffes and angered some inside the Republican establishment, and now you have a situation where people are looking elsewhere for leadership in the party and trying to undercut him. And again, questions become whether or not they are weaker going into this fall election cycle than need be. And Democrats, because of money and President Obama's fundraising might, may actually be in a better position than previously thought.
Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Renee.
NPR's news analyst, Juan Williams.
And now for some perspective, we turn to Professor William Wheaton, MIT economist who watches the housing market. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you very much, Robert.
We just heard from a real estate broker in Manassas, Virginia, who figures they saw the bottom there and things have bounced back to nowhere near where they were before, but not as low as they got. And earlier we heard from the county assessor in Contra Costa County, California, who says it's pretty miserable out there. First of all, which describes more closely the housing market to you nationally?
Neither. There's an old saying that the mean is never achieved. The average house is, we don't really own them, right? We own houses above and below the average. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's a combination of the two.
What to you accounts for this pretty terrible report on housing sales for last month?
Well, there actually was a little bit of a silver lining. The bad news was that sales dropped 25%. The good news was that the inventory of units for sale was basically stable. And the way we look at it, that means that most of the withdrawal of sales came from existing owners who were trying to move from one house to the next, from one part of the country to the next. If the withdrawal of sales had come from first-time buyers or investors, then we would have seen the inventory of units climb quite sharply. So I think it was mostly existing owners who sort of, you know, put themselves on the sidelines for the last month, quite possibly because of the withdrawal of the tax credit, but also because the labor market is so tenuous and difficult at this point.
These are uncertain times. It's a tough time in which to make a big commitment to,
that's exactly right,
to a home. I read one forecast for the coming year from Goldman Sachs that came out last month. They say given the supply of houses out there, they would expect prices to decline by another 2.5% over the coming year.
I think that's entirely realistic. I would expect that prices actually won't do very much of anything. I don't think they'll take a, certainly won't take a big run up, and might fall a couple percentage points. None of that's going to be very catastrophic or very optimistic either way. I think we're really pretty close to the bottom, but it could be a long slog along the bottom.
What does all this say about what has been a very basic economic and social policy objective for the U.S. to increase home ownership? Are we at a point now where people are looking at renting and perhaps at how often they might have to move to find a new job over the course of their working lives and say, you know, renting makes more sense, it's a better deal?
Well, I think that's very important because if you look at the rental market, it really stands in pretty stark contrast to this morning's report on the ownership market. In the last two quarters, the vacancy rate in apartments has fallen from 7% down to 5%. Rents have firmed and started to rise. And, of course, you have to remember rents didn't fall very, very much. They move quite differently than prices. In the last 12 months, nationally, there were 830,000 new renters, whereas we lost 40 or 50,000 owners. So the rental market looks to be quite strong. And, of course, it's benefiting from the enormous number of people moving from own back to rent.
Have you seen any creative idea out there about this whole equation, people, homes, ownership, renting, whatever, that might seem to be a path for us to get out of this depressed market?
Well, there are some interesting ideas in the short run. One idea I really like is for banks to write down mortgages to something near what properties are actually worth. This is for people that financed or bought a house at the peak and now prices have fallen considerably. So banks would refinance those mortgages at a much lower rate, and then they would take a share of any equity when those houses sold.
So the bank ceases to be simply your creditor, but it's also your partner to some extent.
That's right, your equity partner, and that would free up people to move. I think some idea like that is really needed at this point.
Professor Wheaton, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Delighted.
William Wheaton is an economist at MIT.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tina Brown of the Daily Beast is with us again this morning for our regular feature, Word of Mouth. She's brought some reading suggestions to get us through these long days of summer. Good morning, Tina.
Good morning, Renee. Good to talk to you.
Let's start with a piece in Harvard Business Review. It's an interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And people might remember he stepped down in 2000 when Starbucks was at the height of success, didn't expect to return, only he did 2 years ago to rebuild the company. What's interesting about this particular article is its title, We Have to Own the Mistakes. What does he mean by that?
Well, he talks about how you really have to own up to the mistakes that you in your company have made yourself, face them, share them with your staff in order to move on. And he says it's like when you have a secret and get it out, the burden is off your shoulders.
One thing, though, he says is he, by coming back, could do things another CEO, an outside CEO, could never have done. And among them was, I mean, he could truly embrace what he called, it's a cliche in a way, but the culture, the core values of the company.
What he really saw was that the culture had gone off whack, that it had just two things had happened. First of all, there had been a volcanic climate, suddenly a huge recession where customers' entire patterns had changed. The rise of social media, which meant that one negative piece in a far-flung organ could suddenly smear the entire company. And also a sense that the company had lost touch with its customer core value thrust, because this company had very, very defined corporate culture, which was really about serving the customer, about being a decent human citizen, about giving people pleasure, but also giving people service in a way that he felt had kind of gone off track.
There are people who see Starbucks in a very different way, kind of, oh no, another Starbucks.
That's what he wanted to get away from, and he really set about remarketing the company and reinventing it. And he also said, you know, how everybody would course want him to cut costs aggressively at a time of restructuring, which is what most people would, of course, mandate. And he did cut costs. But he also did something very, very inspiring, in my view. Just at a point when everybody was saying you must cut costs, you've got to refocus, you've got to do all this, he actually took 4,500 members of his company to New Orleans to spend a week doing community service, working there, and then having a conference about their core values. And it was a very sort of enlightened, visionary, but also rebranding exercise, where he says, this is a company that cares about people. What's the biggest statement we can make that says that? And he did this. And it was a terrific success and really did help an enormous amount in reminding people that Starbucks actually was a company that cared about people and customers.
Another example of a kind of growth is last Sunday's New York Times Magazine piece on 20-somethings. And Tina, here, actually, it's an article that many might set aside initially thinking, I think I've read this before, 20-somethings living at home. But in fact, this article gives a whole other underpinning to what's going on with 20-somethings who are, in a way, not quite growing up the way they used to.
Well, this writer, Robin Marantz-Hennig, is talking about something that sociologists and psychiatrists are sort of beginning to think of as emerging adulthood. You know, she says, we now know, for instance, that the brains of young people are still developing at the age of 25. And the author says, maybe it's only now when people are allowed to forestall adult obligations without fear of public censure that the rate of social maturation can finally fall into better sync with the maturation of the brain. You know, in other words, actually, the brain isn't really mature until 25. But in the past, economic, social circumstances have forced kids out really before they're truly mature, and that now that there are these new economic and social circumstances, that they are actually taking longer to mature. And of course, we also have, to accelerate this issue, a terrible job market where kids are finding a tough time anyway getting a job. But it is an interesting question. I mean, I have to say that I tend to feel, having read it, that this is really much more an index of privilege than not. I mean, you have to ask yourself how fast kids returning who go to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq have to mature, like it or not, whether or not they are matured mentally, putting themselves in great stress and danger or something is going to really change their maturity. There's no question about it. But it is an interesting thing because it is very much a modern phenomenon of kids continually going back home to live, sort of looking to their parents all the time still for not just financial help, but also sort of emotional help.
You finally take us back in history, and you're suggesting a book by Juliet Nicholson called The Great Silence, written from the shadow of the First World War to the dawn of the Jazz Age, to a time I think very few Americans even think about, this moment after young people in Britain were forced through a really terrible time of change and death for many of them.
Yes, I think one of the reasons I felt a little impatient with the findings of emerging adulthood was I was simultaneously reading Juliet Nicholson's wonderful book, The Great Silence, which does talk about the moment when Britain lost literally the flower of its youth in that terrible, terrible war to end all wars, as it was called. And she describes brilliantly in a series of social anecdotes and snapshots of real people, 35 characters going about their daily life, below stairs people as well as royalty, as well as famous writers and artists, where she dips into their diaries, into their letters, and creates a portrait of these 2 years, which she calls the Great Silence because of the famous 2 minutes of silence where everything in England stopped at one moment and the war dead were remembered. What we don't think about is the devastating trauma of what it was like when one in seven young men in England had died. And she talks about how the everyday scenes of such loss and grief that no one could really enjoy or rejoice or feel there was a peace because there'd been too much loss and pain in the country. I mean, she describes scenes like, for instance, riding the bus and suddenly some woman would just break into wild tears as something had reminded her of her son or her brother or somebody in her family. Or she would talk about men walking the streets of London wearing these strange, eerie tin masks because their faces had been shot away, which became a regular sight in the UK at that time. And she also describes a terrifically interesting chapter, actually, on a surgeon called Howard Gillis, who was so affected by the tin masks that he saw that he developed a revolutionary plastic surgery technique that actually reconstructed faces and, of course, became a lasting legacy to the medical world. So it's really, I found, an absolutely gripping piece.
For you, do these tales of survival, do they add up to any one thing?
Well, to me, it's really about character in the face of stress and how, in the case of Howard Schultz, he showed enormous character and audacity and vision. In the case of these kids, it seems that they haven't really faced up to the stresses of people like Schultz are writing about yet. They are unwilling to face them, if you like. They haven't yet had their test that could perhaps be their defining character moment. And, of course, the people in the Great War, they were given the ultimate test, and they had to meet it in the most terrifying way, and did meet it, actually, and did so with enormous courage, with a very tragic outcome. But you do have to admire these people who returned under such terrifying circumstances and simply had to pick up and carry on.
Tina, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Rennie.
You can find links to Tina's reading recommendations at npr.org.
Noam Spencer is an Israeli-born clinical psychologist who has a practice and teaches in Ohio, and he's just published his first novel. It's called, what else, The Good Psychologist. Alan Chu says the author brings the authority of his professional expertise to his storytelling.
We enter the psychologist's office and serve as flies on the wall while he meets patients old and new. We eavesdrop on his telephone conversations and witness his few rendezvous with Nina, a psychologist from another city with whom he's fathered a child. We attend his university lectures on the practice of psychotherapy, in which he gives a number of memorable examples on what constitutes a good psychologist. The good psychologist, he tells his students, is not infatuated with humanity. The good psychologist, he says, deals with story and identity, and he who deals with story and identity deals with memory. The good psychologist knows that change, any change within known boundaries, is in itself therapeutically valuable. The good psychologist has also got to be a believable character if we're going to follow him into therapy sessions with a clinically depressed young woman who works as a nude dancer at a local strip club. As I describe this element of the story, it seems a little over the top, exaggerating an already interesting profession by raising the question of prurience and therapist-patient relations, but somehow it all works. For the sake of full disclosure, I have to say that my wife is a therapist, though I have never been in therapy. After reading Noam Spencer's intensely rendered first novel, I feel as though I've done it.
Noam Spencer's book is The Good Psychologist. Our reviewer is Alan Schuss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is the case that for inspiration, young people often turn to outstanding athletes as role models. Commentator Frank DeFord laments the current crop.
This must be a terrible time for the children of America. We've always been told that our little tykes need to look up to star athletes. But one way or another, our heroes are either being disgraced or getting injured or just plain disappearing. At this rate, our nation of worshipful boys and girls will have to turn its lonely eyes away from sports stars to actors or reality show people, or heaven forbid, to politicians. It all starts, of course, with Tiger Woods, and we do not have to elaborate on that except to say that now poor Phil Mickelson has arthritis, so golf is down to number three. Only, of course, there is no number three. The networks who bring us golf tournaments are completely discombobulated. They keep showing us Tiger Woods instead of who is actually winning the tournament. No golf journalists remember how to cover golf the way it was pre-Tiger Woods. So, as a consequence, not only is Tiger Woods a bad memory we can't escape, but golf itself has disappeared down a rabbit hole. Meanwhile, in women's golf, first Annika Sörenstam, the closest thing to a female Tiger in our time, retired to start a family. So now the women's tour doesn't exist either. It's like Snow White waiting for some tournament to kiss Michelle Wee and finally make her the fairest of them all. Lance Armstrong is a fading Tinkerbell. Clap, boys and girls, if you're sucker enough to believe in him. Ben Roethlisberger, Middle America's blue-collar quarterback, is suspended for being, well, extremely nasty. The less said about Roger Clemens, the better. Too bad for old Roger that he felt obliged to say more. Roger Federer carried tennis on his back. All of a sudden, he's just another aging quarterfinalist. Serena Williams seldom shows up to play, and now she's really hurt and can't play in the U.S. Open. Usain Bolt, the world's fastest human ever, got beat, is injured, and his departure from the track is as damaging to the popularity of his sport as it was when Simon left American Idol. Overnight, LeBron James, who modestly calls himself the chosen one, went from you're so fine to what were you thinking? And now everybody outside Miami-Dade County roots against the best player in the game. It's like some evil genius is sitting in some cave cackling maniacally as he picks off our poor dear children's heroes one by one. So please, yes, let's give a rousing cheer that Brett Favre has once again decided that we need him. Speaking for the children of America, thank you, Brett, for coming back again and again and again.
Frank DeVord comes to us with sports every Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.